morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live for a half hour each weekday morning, taking phone calls from listeners like yourself who have questions they'd like to ask about the Bible or the Christian faith, or maybe have an alternate viewpoint and would like to discuss that with the host. In either case, all you need to do is use your telephone and call me at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. Our first caller, well, I'm going to wait just a second here until I see who our first caller is. Looks like our first caller is Jai, sounds like, from Winnetka, California. I'm not sure if I'm reading the name properly. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Excuse me, what did you say? Welcome? Yes.
Yes, I said welcome. Is this Jai? Is that your name?
It is, okay. And the question is, in Genesis 12, 7 and 8, Abram built altars on the way to Canaan and to give, and it doesn't say that he offered a sacrifice. So would he have built an altar without offering a sacrifice? And if he did, would he or any of his family eaten any of it?
Well, I believe that altars were built generally for sacrifice. Yes, that's what an altar was for. Now, sometimes the characters in the Bible will set up a monument, which is not an altar. They'll set up a stone or something like that, and of course it will not be used for sacrifice. But if it's specifically an altar, it is used as a shrine for worship. It's a place where sacrifices are offered. So even though it doesn't mention him offering sacrifices, I think it is implied when it says he built an altar there. It's like if we said so-and-so built a prayer chapel next to their house, we would assume that they go in there and pray even if we're not told.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as whether he ate some of the sacrifices, I would assume that would be the case. I'm not sure. There are, of course, different kinds of sacrifices. He might have offered whole burnt offerings in which no part of the animal was eaten, but it was all burnt up. So I don't really know which kinds of sacrifices he offered. You know, the Bible does talk about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sin offering and the guilt offering.
Right, we don't know if all those different offerings were delineated in his day. You know, in the law, much later, God did delineate between different kinds of offerings, but in the patriarchal times before Moses, there may have only been one kind of sacrifice for all I know. I mean, we don't have record of that, at least not in Scripture.
No. I thought you'd have an opinion, though.
Yeah. Well, I guess my opinion is that back in Abram's day, the sacrificial religion was probably very simple because there was no law, there was no ritual that had been designated by God, and therefore it may well be that they had just burned the whole animal up on the altar, whereas later on in the days of Moses, special kinds of sacrifices were ordered where a person would have to take part of the animal and do something else with it besides burn it. But I don't know, I think in Abraham's day there wasn't much in the way of complexity in religion because God hadn't really given any specific rituals. Yeah.
So you're saying it could have or might not have also entailed a barbecue where they could have had some. You don't really know.
Right.
I don't know either.
That's right. I don't know either. But certainly later on in the days of Moses, many of the sacrifices did entail a barbecue.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, Jai, thanks for calling.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. You can reach me here on the air at this number, 1-800-227-5278. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith or the Christian life or your own spiritual journey, give me a call. The number again is 1-800-227-5278. I have a question that was written in. Somebody says, does Satan know what we are thinking? I'm not sure how much Satan knows about what we're thinking. I do believe that Satan introduces thoughts to our minds, but of course it's possible for me to whisper something in someone's ear without my knowing what else is going on in their mind. However, if Satan does introduce a thought, he knows that it's there, obviously, because he introduced it. But whether he can really just read your thoughts like I believe God can, I really don't know. Some people think he can. Some people think that mind readers, you know, or people who seem to have the ability to read minds, are, you know, inspired by demonic powers. And therefore, if so, then the demonic powers and Satan himself would, in fact, be able to read minds. But I don't really know. The Bible does not say that knowing your thoughts is a power that is exclusively God's power. After all, even if you can't read somebody's thoughts like a book, you often know what they're thinking, especially if you know them well. If you've observed somebody for many years and you know how they react to certain stimuli, certain things they see, certain things they hear, you've heard them express their views. You might know they have strong views. You know what buttons get pushed and make them have, you know, reactions and so forth. There's a lot of times, if you've lived with someone like a husband or a wife or your child or your parents for many years, that you know that something that happens is going to have them thinking certain things. You know, if you know somebody well, you often can say, I know what you're thinking. And you're probably right, because there's certain things that have just been said or done before them that you know what their inward reaction is simply by having a history of knowing them and seeing their previous reactions. So if Satan has observed us all our lives, then probably, even if he doesn't have mind-reading powers, which I don't know if he does or not, probably a lot of the times he knows exactly what we're thinking, because anyone who knew us well would be able to tell that, just because we are predictable people in some measures. But I can't tell for sure how much Satan may know. The Bible doesn't tell us. Let's talk to John from Denver, Colorado. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Morning, Steve. Always a pleasure to talk with you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I had a question about the historicist view of Revelation. Concerning the 1,260 days in chapters 11 through 13, I'm kind of wondering, was anybody outside of an Adventist historian subscribed to the view of 538 when the Ostrogoths abandoned their siege of Rome to 1798 as the start and fall of the papacy, or 606 or to 1870, which seems to be like the two biggest dates that are given for that time period? But I can't seem to really find it outside of the Adventist Church, you know, and Adventist publications. And it almost seems that many historians, and especially Catholic historians, will just say flat out, that's absolutely not true. General Berthier, when he took Pius VI, made like a slight hiccup in history, but didn't end the Vatican or papal power whatsoever.
Well, yeah, what you're referring to, and you may be speaking over the heads of most of our listeners, is that's okay. Let me try to clarify it for them, though. There's a view of Revelation which was held by, especially the Reformers, is still held by the Seventh-day Adventists, and has been around. At one time, it was the primary view of Protestants up until about the 19th century, and maybe even into the 19th century. It was called the historicist view, and the view was that the book of Revelation is mapping out the whole of church history from John's time till the end. In other words, they weren't seeing it as a book about 7 years at the end of the world, but it was really a book about the whole 2,000 years of church history, which, of course, in their day was not yet 2,000 years, but the whole period from the time of John to the end of the world. Now, what the historicist view did is they took time designations in the book of Revelation and substituted a year for a day. That is to say, they had a principle of interpretation, a day for a year, where they felt that if a period of time in Revelation was said to be a certain number of days, it really was supposed to be that number of years. And since the beast, his blasphemies continue for 1,260 days, they said, well, the beast is the papacy, and therefore the papacy's power would last for 1,260 years, a year per day. So that's how they were thinking, and the Seventh-day Adventists still think that way. Most Protestants have abandoned that view, and I don't think there's much good reason to hold to it, but you're asking whether, the papacy is usually thought to have begun with around the year 600 with Pope Gregory the Great, although, of course, the papacy was evolving for a long time before then, and it's just hard to say exactly when the first bishop of Rome could be called a pope in the modern sense of the word, but most historians would say Pope Gregory around AD 600, And so historicist translators of Revelation often would say that the 1260 years of the papal power began in 600 AD and would end around 60 or something like that. Now, you're asking, is there any real historical evidence that the papal power experienced anything seriously damaging to its power in the 1800s in fulfillment of this expectation? Is that what you're asking?
You're right. When under Napoleon and, you know, the general and Pius VI's captivity, and was it, would you really
right.
consider
yeah,
that an end of the papal power?
Well, you know, what they think is, they think that the seven bowls of wrath, which are the seven last plagues in the Book of Revelation, that they were fulfilled during the French Revolution. And so they tend to see the fulfillment of all this happening in France, and with Napoleon and the capture of the Pope and so forth. I mean, this works for them. But of course, the question we've got to ask is, why would the Book of Revelation focus only on what's going on in France, or for that matter, in Europe, or for that matter, on the Western Church in general? Why would the Book of Revelation concern itself only with the Western Church and the papacy, when, you know, the Church of the East and the Eastern Orthodox and the Coptic churches in Africa and so forth were every bit as significant, just not as significant for our culture because we're Westerners. But it's a rather provincial approach to Revelation to say, you know, God gave this vast outline of church history, but only concentrated on church history in Europe and not in the rest of the world, where the church was also doing significant things. I don't think the view has much to its credit, but as far as whether the capture of the Pope in the 1800s was the end of the papal power, I don't know that I would see it that way. Although there, you know, the papal power certainly did diminish for centuries after the Reformation.
Absolutely.
You know, so yeah, but I wouldn't say that what happened in the French Revolution was somehow, you know, the end of it. Although one could argue that the power of the Pope is much, much diminished in the last few centuries over what it had once been. But again, I don't know that there's a particular date that really stands out as the end of the papal power compared to what it used to be. So I'm saying I don't know of any historians, other than historicist translators or interpreters of Revelation, that would necessarily see that as such a significant event.
All right, well, thank you for your thoughts on this, Stephen. I love your book. I always go to it. It's a great reference source. It's absolutely fantastic. I used it for my class last year when I taught a year-long course to Revelation. We're going to use it again. So, and just thank you for your wonderful work that you have brought to the body of Christ. That is fantastic, again.
Thank you, John. I appreciate that.
No problem, brother. You have a blessed day.
You too. God bless you. For those who don't know, John is referring to a book that I wrote back in 1997 called Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary. And it compares four views of Revelation side by side in parallel columns through the whole book. It's an unusual book, but it's still in print. Thomas Nelson published it in 1997. You can still buy it. It's called Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary. Let's talk to Ellie from Altadena, California. Hi,
nice.
Ellie. Welcome.
I was concerned about where was the 1,000 years of peace. I've been to Patmos, and they claim there were no 1,000 years of peace yet. Did you know the island Patmos? Where
yes,
John,
uh-huh.
They said it was John the Apostle. But they said there were no 1,000 years of peace. So I wonder how we can be sure that everything happened. That Nero was the Antichrist, is that correct?
Well, that is certainly one view. One view is that Nero was the beast in Revelation, yeah. Now, the 1,000 years of peace is mentioned only in the end of Revelation. It's mentioned in Revelation chapter 20 and nowhere else. And actually, it doesn't say 1,000 years of peace. It says it's 1,000 years during which the saints reign with Christ. There's no mention particularly of peace during that time, except it suggests there might be relative peace of a sort because the devil is said to be bound during that time. But The idea that it's 1,000 years of peace, that is the peace as a primary feature, comes from equating that passage in Revelation 20 with some Old Testament passages that do talk about peace, people beating their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation not lifting up sword against nation or learning war anymore. Passages like Isaiah 2 and Micah chapter 4, people equate those with Revelation 20, and that brings in the idea of peace during that period of time. But Revelation doesn't mention the peace. Although, of course, when the 1,000 years is over, it does mention a war. So, you know, again, it may be implied or assumed that maybe peace is the feature of that 1,000 years. There are different views of the 1,000 years, and there's nobody I know who believes the 1,000 years occurred already and are over.
Then I agree.
Okay.
But
I agree.
Christ come back, because I did understand that Christ would be coming back in the air, you would all see him, and that didn't happen either, did it?
Right. Well, you're thinking now, I assume you're responding to the fact that I believe that much of Revelation was predicting things that have already occurred in the past. I believe that the majority of the book of Revelation is concerned with the Jewish war, which occurred from 66 to 70 A.D., and with the fall of Jerusalem. That view is called the preterist or the partial preterist view. But I don't believe that everything in Revelation is talking about that. I believe that the 1,000 years in Revelation 20 is not talking about that. Now, as far as Jesus coming back, Revelation does talk about, you know, the Lord coming with clouds and things like that. There are references to him coming. What the preterist view, what the preterist person points out, is that in the Bible, the coming of the Lord is an expression that refers to a variety of things in different contexts. Sometimes it refers to him coming, figuratively speaking, coming in judgment. In the Old Testament, it's very common for God's coming either to come to bless the nation or to bring war and destruction on the nation, to be referred to as if God came or God visited or whatever. This is a figure of speech. It's not really saying that God literally showed up visibly. It's saying that the events that have transpired were God's doing, and it's figuratively said, you know, he came and did this. And so in some cases, it seems that when the book of Revelation, or for that matter, other places in the New Testament, speak of the coming of Christ, it's not always talking about what we are looking forward to as the second coming. Sometimes it is. Other times, I think it's referring to events that have already happened, but it's figurative. Jesus coming in judgment on Jerusalem, or as far as that goes, some of the cities, the churches in Revelation, chapters 2 and 3, Jesus says he's going to come to them, and it's going to be bad for them. And, of course, all those cities pretty much are gone now. So whatever Jesus threatened must have happened, and it was not the second coming. But it also wasn't the destruction of Jerusalem. That any judgment on any city or nation in the Bible can be referred to as God coming to them. So what I'm saying is, although I do believe there's a second coming yet to be seen of Jesus Christ in power and glory at the end of the world, there are many events.
I believe that too. Didn't they say Israel would become a nation before any of this happened, and that wasn't until 1948?
Well, actually, the Bible doesn't say that. Prophecy teachers often say that. They say that Israel has become a nation before the second coming or whatever. Israel, of course, has become a nation in 1948, but there was no prediction of that in the Bible. There are predictions in the Bible of the Jews who were scattered in Babylon being brought back to their land, and they did, and even before the time of Christ, those prophecies were fulfilled. There, you find in the Old Testament many predictions about God restoring the Jews from all over the world back to their own land, rebuilding their temple, restoring their worship, and so forth. All of those predictions were made either before the Babylonian captivity or during the Babylonian captivity. That is, all those predictions were made before God brought the Jews back from the Babylonian captivity. So I believe...
they would come on eagle's wings, and how was it, 8,000 or 8 million that came from Russia. I forgot the amount, and that certainly came true.
I understand where you're coming from. Right, I'm familiar with what you're saying. There are people who say that all the Jews returning to Israel in modern times are a fulfillment of prophecy. I don't see any prophecies that predict it. Okay, and now there are people who do, but I see those same prophecies, the same ones they're looking at. I see them differently. I see them as referring to the return of the Jews from Babylon, from the Babylonian exile. And in some cases, I see it as a spiritual return to God that's talking about.
But the Babylonian return had happened long before John wrote the Revelation.
Right, right. But John didn't ever mention the Jews coming back to their land. And like I said, in the Bible, all of the predictions about the Jews' return to their land occurred, all the predictions were made in Old Testament books that were written before the Jews, in fact, did return. But they did. Most of them, the remnant did. I shouldn't say most of them, but as the remnant did return, which is what was predicted. I mean, Isaiah chapter 10 says, though the children of Israel be as the sand of the seashore for multitude, a remnant shall return. Okay, so it says there's a lot of Israelites out in the world, but only a remnant are said to return. Now, Paul understood that to be fulfilled, actually, in the remnant of Israel coming to Christ. And he quoted that verse in Romans 9.
Well,
he said,
down on Patmos, that's not what they said at all. You know, on the Patmos Island where John was...
Well, see, you went to Patmos. You went to Patmos where John saw the vision. And apparently the church there, is this what was the Eastern Orthodox Church you encountered there? Or, who was it that gave you this information?
It's over 20 years, so I can't remember just...
Oh, I see, okay. Did you go on a tour? Did you go on like a Christian tour? Okay, I got it. Okay, well, see, here's the thing. Your tour guide apparently said that John... predicted certain things and that they mean certain things and so forth. But the tour guide is just giving the tour guide's opinion, you see, and I'm giving my opinion, and you can have a third opinion or if you want to. A person is allowed to have an opinion, but you should shape your opinion upon the best possible biblical studies you can do. When I was a younger Bible teacher, I read the scriptures the same way your tour guide did. And I was a dispensationalist too. Your tour guide was apparently a dispensationalist, and I used to be a dispensationalist, and that meant that I interpreted many things in the Bible as having a fulfillment in the last days or the end of the world, which, as I studied the Bible more, I later found out that they were fulfilled in ancient times. The reason I was applying these things to the end of the world was because I was very ignorant of the history and very ignorant of the language of the Bible itself. And so many people have made this same pilgrimage I've made. They start out as a default, holding that many passages in the Bible are about the end of the world, but as they study the Bible itself, and especially as they get away from those dispensational teachers who are always telling them what the Bible is supposed to mean, and you begin to see in the context what the passages say, many people, like myself, have moved away from the assumptions. But your tour guide at Patmos, who told you those things, he apparently has not moved away from those assumptions. So he has seen the book of Revelation a certain way, in a futuristic way, and probably a dispensational way, especially if he's arguing that the return of the Jews to their land in 1948 was somehow a fulfillment of something in Revelation. I'd be curious to know which passage in Revelation he thinks fulfilled, because there is no reference in the book of Revelation to the Jews coming back to their land, and there is no, in fact, reference anywhere in the New Testament. None of the New Testament books ever make any reference whatsoever to the Jews returning to their land. It's just not there. Where you do find predictions of the Jews' return to the land is in the Old Testament, in prophetic books that are written before the Jews returned from the Babylonian exile. So, you know, if a prophet says, God is going to gather his people from all the lands that he's driven them to and bring them back to their land. And then it happens after the prediction was made. Then you can assume the prediction is fulfilled. And that's how I look at it. Now, some people say, but couldn't there be a second fulfillment? Couldn't there be double fulfillment? Well, there could be, of course. Of course there could be. God can do whatever he wants to. He can have 3 or 4 or 10 fulfillments of one prophecy if he wants to. I don't know of any instances of him doing so. But as I do know of some instances of God having a double fulfillment of a prophecy, or what seems to be, instead of double fulfillment, I think I would say that there was a first fulfillment that was a type and a shadow of a later fulfillment. And the later fulfillment was always in Christ. Wherever I don't know of any exceptions to this, wherever there seems to be a double fulfillment of prophecy, the first fulfillment happened before the time of Christ and was a type of Christ. And then the second fulfillment was in Christ himself. I don't know of any prophecies that had a double fulfillment that came about, you know, beyond the time of Christ. Christ is the focus of biblical prophecy. He's the ultimate fulfillment of all biblical prophecy. He is what it's all about. Jesus said, in the volume of the book it is written of me. And Jesus said, Moses and the prophets and Psalms all wrote about him. But many people, they don't see Jesus as the fulfillment. They see the modern day Israel as the fulfillment, or something like that. In which case, I think they're guilty of a replacement. It's not really what's called replacement theology. It's the opposite, but they've replaced Jesus, who belongs in the center of prophetic consideration, and they've replaced him with Israel, which I think is a mistake. Not everyone agrees with me, obviously, and so we'll just have to disagree. But I appreciate your call, Ellie. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay a lot of money to radio stations to stay on the air. That money all comes from listeners like you, and it sometimes is barely there. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com, and find out how to help us out. God bless you. We'll talk again tomorrow, Lord willing.